It's the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS. Thanks for listening. You can email me, Paul at harrisonline.com. Follow me on Twitter at Paul Harris Show. And follow the radio station on Twitter and Facebook as well, 550 KTRS. I emailed Jen Chaney, the TV critic for Vulture, a couple of weeks ago and said, hey, you know, we're coming to the end of the year. Why don't you come on the show and talk about what were the best and worst TV shows of the year? And Jen said, oh, absolutely, I'd love to. And then today I wrote to her and said, can we also talk about that Fox presentation of A Christmas Story Live, the live three-hour musical that they aired last night? And she emailed me back and she said, well, I had to sit through it, so we might as well. And I think that tells you what Jen thought of the show. Hi, Jen.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm fine. I couldn't make it through the whole 3 hours. I lasted about an hour and a half, and then I had to bail. So you know what I thought of it. What did you think of it?
Well, okay, so here's the thing. This was an adaptation of a musical that pre-existed. It was on Broadway, and obviously it's based on the movie from 1983 that airs every year for 24 hours on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I have a very personal connection to that movie, and it means a lot to me. And I had never seen the musical on stage, so this was my first encounter with it.
Okay, let's stop right there. Wait, what's the personal connection?
Oh, just like many people. I remember seeing it when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see it with my mom, and I remember coming out of the theater with my mom and my best friend at the time, and it actually started snowing when we walked out of the theater.
Wow.
And it's just one of those movies that my parents loved it. Like, everyone in our family loved it long before I think it became sort of a widely known cult favorite.
Yeah,
so,
the same thing for me. I actually have a little more backstory than that, which is that I grew up listening to Gene Shepherd on the radio. He was a great radio monologist who had a nightly show for an hour where he would just spin these stories about his fictional past growing up in Homan, Indiana, and about the old man and the old lady and Flick and Schwartz and Grover Dill and all the rest of the characters, which he then wrote in books, including Wanda Hicks and her Night of Golden Memories, and In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, which is what the movie is based on. And he, of course, was the narrator in the movie and co-wrote the script for the movie. So that was my connection to it, and it became one of my beloved holiday movies as well when I first saw it in 1983. So we both had some background with this. All right, so now come forward to 2017, and here's what Fox does.
Here's what Fox does. So they do a live musical. That's basically the live musical that was on Broadway with some, you know, modifications here and there. They added a song. They changed some things about the way that they staged certain aspects of it. And I just kind of had a problem with the material itself. Not so much the performers, because they had great actors. They had Maya Rudolph. They had Matthew Broderick doing the narration in lieu of Gene Shepherd. And I thought he did a nice job. I thought it was a little strange that, you know, he was so visible, so he was constantly, like, haunting the scenes and kind of moving through the rooms, and I wasn't sure if that staging really worked.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, what's great about A Christmas Story, the movie, and the Gene Shepherd's writing, is that it's simultaneously nostalgic, but it also has a cynical streak running through it.
Yes.
And I think, certainly when I saw that movie, which also made me interested in Gene Shepherd's writing, as you referred to, at the time, like, most Christmas movies really weren't like that. This was well before Bad Santa. So to see a movie that had a little bit of darkness in it was kind of, you know, funny and great. And I think the musical just completely doesn't get that at all. So it's very sunny and happy in a lot of ways that I don't think match the sensibility of what it's supposed to, or what it was originally anyway.
I'm glad you mentioned the kind of cynicism that was in Shep's voice when he did the original, because it was always there in his radio shows, and that's what was missing with Matthew Broderick. He is a likable guy, but you know what this needed? This needed the Matthew Broderick from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And instead, we got Matthew Broderick, the nice middle-aged dad guy who is having a kind of pleasant memory about something that happened in his childhood, which is not the way Shepherd wrote it.
Right. And again, I think that speaks less to what to Broderick's abilities as an actor than what he was being directed to do and what the script dictates, because I just think that adaptation of what this is doesn't, like I said, it doesn't match what Gene Shepherd had in mind. And that was what kept bothering me throughout the entire production, even though some of the numbers were really well done.
All right, now I got to mention a couple other things that bothered me about this. The movie, A Christmas Story, is a tight 94 minutes. You get an hour and a half. You get the story all laid out for you. You get all the characters. We wrap it up, and we're done. The musical took 3 hours. That's twice as long as the original. And we filled up that time with all these songs. Now, I will say, the guys who wrote the songs for this are the same guys who wrote some of the songs for La La Land, which won Academy Awards. I can't remember a single song from A Christmas Story Live, the musical. Not one.
Yeah, they also wrote Dear Evan Hansen, which a really well-regarded show on Broadway.
Yep.
So it is... These guys are definitely very talented. I just didn't like the direction they took it in. But I will say, in its defense, the show was not actually 3 hours long, because if you take out the commercials or you count the commercials, I think maybe it only was a 90-minute musical, and the other 90 minutes was commercials, because there were so many breaks.
That's true. Yeah, with the Fox promos and everything else in there. And by the way,
I didn't know there was an Old Navy in Indiana in the 1940s, but I learned that from A Christmas Story.
I also didn't know that there were so many different races hanging out together in Holman, Indiana in the 1940s.
Right. Well, I think that part I do understand. I understand why they updated it. They also updated the Chinese restaurant scene and changed that at the very end.
Yeah.
And I think that was actually an astute move on their part. But So I don't have a problem with that. The commercials, though, they were a lot.
Did you have a problem with the fact that when he's going through his fantasy performance of Ralphie Saves the World, he doesn't have a gun, even though the movie is about a kid wanting a gun?
You know what bothered me more, actually, was the way they handled the whole the breaking of the major award, the leg lamp, which, in the movie, Melinda Dillon's character, she clearly does it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
She's clearly annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way for her to slyly kind of get back at her husband. And they don't really ever talk about it again. And it's one of those grudges that they both kind of quietly hold against each other for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
Which is perfect. That's,
yep.
That's how that marriage would have been.
Yep.
Marriage is nothing if not quiet grudges that you hold for the rest of your life. But in this version, the husband and the wife, they have this sort of nice moment and they make up. And I'm like, no. That's not how it would have been.
Yeah. I like Maya Rudolph as the wife. She has been struggling to find the right position for herself in the entertainment landscape ever since leaving Saturday Night Live. She had that ridiculous variety show of her own, and she did a variety show with Martin Short that was even worse. And she's so talented, but she just can't find the right vehicle for her. I actually thought, okay, she's doing a pretty good job in this miserable production of A Christmas Story. I liked her, and I liked Jane Krakowski. But for the rest of it, 3 hours I'll never get back. And I didn't even spend the full 3 hours.
I also thought Anna Gasteyer was really great, and she was playing Schwartz's mom, who was really barely a character in the movie.
Yeah.
And they sort of expanded that role, and they gave her an entire song about Hanukkah, which is kind of ridiculous, but she did a great job with that number. I actually liked that number the best, partly because of her performance and also because it was completely separate from the movie. It didn't exist, so I didn't have to compare it to anything before, and that was sort of a relief.
I wonder if there's anybody who sings that song in real life, and somebody else says, where's that Hanukkah song from? Oh, it's from A Christmas Story.
Yeah, they just wrote it for the TV production. It wasn't in the original show.
Oh, really?
That was one of the things they added. So we'll see if it becomes, it may become a Hanukkah staple, for all we know.
I'll bet against it. let's talk about what I originally asked you to come on here to talk about today, which were the best and worst things on TV in 2017. What are a couple of the shows or maybe just scenes that have stuck in your mind all year long?
Well, I actually made, for Vulture, I made two lists, actually. One was just of the best TV shows of 2017 overall, and the other one was the best new shows. There are so many good shows that I actually had very little overlap between the two lists, with one exception, simply because I wanted to highlight as much as I could, and there was enough, more than enough good stuff to go around to fill out two top 10 lists.
Okay.
But my number one on both lists was Big Little Lies, the HBO series with Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman, which aired February to the beginning of April, so it was really early in the year. But it went on to win an Emmy for Best Limited Series, and I just thought it was some of the most fun, smart, moving, interesting television that I watched all year. It was one of those one of those screeners where they showed up in my inbox, and I'm like, I'll start watching this on a Friday night. And I was just blowing through them really, really fast because I just couldn't stop watching it.
Have they announced whether or not it's going to come back for a second season?
Well, the intention with that series was always to be limited. It was supposed to be a single season. It was an adaptation of a novel, and it very clearly told a story that came to an end. But it was so popular and well-liked that a conversation started about, well, is there more story to tell? So, yes, they are doing a second season with all the same cast, and David E. Kelley is going to be writing it based on a story that Leanne Moriarty, who wrote the novel, came up with. So it is going to come back. And I have mixed feelings about that, but I liked it so much that I am intrigued to see where they go with it.
Are your mixed feelings because part of you says you reached the end of the story? Leave it.
Yeah, exactly. That was my initial response when I heard they were starting to talk about a second one. I was like, you know, come on.
Okay.
But I trust the people involved in making it. And even, you know, Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman, who starred in it, are both executive producers. And it, from what I have read, one of my colleagues wrote a piece about this and talked to people involved. They actually thought pretty deeply about it and had the same kind of reservation. So I'm hopeful that that means that they have come up with something that really will be good and justify,
all right, that's,
you know, its
that's
existence.
Big Little Lies. What else is on your list?
Well, on my list of overall shows, my number two was The Leftovers, which is also an HBO series about the aftermath of a rapture-like event. And the fourth season aired this year, and it was the last, or pardon me, I guess it was the third season. It was the last season. It was the end of the show. And I don't know if, I feel like not enough people were watching that. So if you have the opportunity over the winter break, take some time and watch it. It's just a phenomenal, phenomenal series. I also have a lot of stuff from Netflix on both of my lists. I think Netflix really established itself pretty solidly as maybe the best network/streaming platform in television this year.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because they just put out so much stuff. And when you put out that much stuff, the odds that you're going to have some good stuff in it are that much higher. But nevertheless, I thought BoJack Horseman, which this was in its fourth season, is still one of the funniest shows on TV and also goes to these really surprisingly heartbreaking places. I was really pleased with the second season of Stranger Things, which is another example of a show that I thought, why are they doing a second one? It was fine just as a standalone.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second season for me was just as good and in some ways even better than the first. And in terms of some of the new shows, you know, we were talking about Maya Rudolph earlier. She did the voice in this animated series on Netflix called Big Mouth that's about a bunch of middle schoolers going through puberty. And it looks at that in a very frank and graphic way, and it's funny, but it's also, again, like, really astute, insightful look at what is involved in that really difficult time period in a kid's life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the best things I've ever seen about an adolescence period on TV.
Wow.
And she does the voice of the hormone monstress who's sort of coaching the main female character about how to handle her raging hormones. Maya Rudolph is great in it. She's great.
Speaking of streaming shows, did you have The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on your list?
I do. I have it on my list of best new shows. That was one that's on Amazon, and
mm-hmm.
it came on, you know, just in November. It's created by Amy Sherman-Palladino, who's best known for Gilmore Girls, and it has that, you know, same kind of whip-smart, crackling dialogue that Gilmore Girls was known for. It's about a woman who is in the 1950s in New York. Her marriage falls apart, and she starts pursuing stand-up comedy, sort of loosely based on Joan Rivers, but very loosely because there are certain things that do not match Joan Rivers' story.
No.
But yeah, it's a really fun, engaging show.
Yeah, very, very well written and very, very well cast. The woman who plays Susie, who turns out to be Mrs. Maisel's manager and maybe friend,
mm-hmm.
Just terrific in that role. Both the lead and that character, both terrific. And as you said, the dialogue is just crackling and clever and adult and really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a fan of that one, too.
Okay. Let me mention a couple of shows that would be on my list if I had made one. One of them is The Deuce, the HBO series starring Maggie Gyllenhaal at a time when things were starting to open up in the porn world back in the 1970s, right?
Yes, that's right.
Did you like it?
I did. I have to be honest. I still haven't finished it, not because I didn't like it, but because my colleague, Matt Zoller-Seitz, he was writing that review, and so I started watching it, but I didn't have to write about it, so I sort of backburnered it while I was watching other things, and I need to circle back and finish watching it. But I did like it, what I saw of it, and Matt did put it on his best of the year list. So yeah.
The only thing I didn't like about it is that they have James Franco playing twin brothers, and there's no reason to have one actor playing two characters in this show. Not that I have anything against James Franco. I like him. It's just it's distracting sometimes when he walks into the room and you go, which brother is this?
Right. Yeah, that was an issue, and that was something actually we talked about that in one of our news meetings at Vulture, that other people were having that same problem. But I think that is a true story. There were those twin brothers, so I think they're based on real people.
Oh, okay.
So I think they kind of had to do twins, and then when you got to do twins, you may as well, you know, cast the same actor. But yeah, it can definitely get confusing.
All right, and also I wanted to mention the FX series Better Things, which is written by and directed by and stars Pamela Adlon. This was their second season on this show, and she really took the reins of everything this year. But I wonder if that show has been tainted by Pamela's friendship and longtime co-working relationship with Louis C.K., who also co-wrote many of the episodes. And then we found out about Louis C.K.'s proclivities over the course of the last few months. Has that affected that show, Better Things, future?
You know, I hope not, too. That was also on my best of the year list. I love that show. I think Pamela Adlon is terrific. And, you know, it's great to see a woman really acting as an auteur in the TV world in the way that she is. They did renew it for a third season. And obviously, FX kind of parted ways with Louis C.K., so I don't think he's going to be involved in the same way, if at all, going forward. But, you know, I think the show is really, in my view, it's her voice, and she certainly has the capacity to carry on without him. Hopefully, you know, it won't affect people's interest in watching it, because I think it's a great show, and she deserves, you know, the credit for that.
Yeah, speaking of carrying on without a guy, let's roll with this theme and talk about the morning news shows. CBS has got to roll on without Charlie Rose, and NBC has to roll on without Matt Lauer. Is there a long-term impact on this, do you think?
I think it's too early to say, although it appears that the ratings on the Today Show have actually gone up. Huh. Matt Lauer left. I think it started beating Good Morning America again, and that may just be a short-term thing, you know, because it's been in the news, people are more curious to see how they carry on without Matt Lauer. Or it could speak to, you know, maybe some people weren't watching because of Matt Lauer. Now that he's gone, they're more interested again. It's hard to say.
Mm.
You know, I think it's really going to depend on, especially in the Today Show's case, who ends up replacing him, because there have been all these rumors about who that might be, and they haven't announced that yet. And certainly it's an opportunity for someone else to, you know, establish themselves as a personality in a really high-profile role.
It's interesting, in both of those shows, the women have moved to front and center on those shows, and the ratings are going up. So that's a good thing. Now, as you say, it may be curiosity tune in at this point, and we'll see who ends up getting the role full-time. I would assume that Hoda Kotb can't be the answer for NBC next to Savannah Guthrie, but what do I know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, if only because she's supposed to be on in the 10 a.m. hour, too, with Kathy Lee Gifford.
Yeah.
I would think they would want somebody different just to diversify things a little bit. But, you know, they've always seemed to have this unwritten rule that you need to have one woman and one man, and there's really no reason why that needs to be the case.
I agree. Let me go back to streaming for just a second. This is the year that CBS had their over-the-top service All Access kind of debut, and they had that spinoff from The Good Wife and the new Star Trek series, and I guess they're going to produce more original content for that. Is that working? Are people subscribing to that?
You know, I don't know what their subscription numbers are, but just from my perspective, I feel like both the shows you mentioned, The Good Fight and the Star Trek show, would have been such bigger parts of the cultural conversation had they been on regular CBS. I think, you know, they were both good shows. I didn't really watch Star Trek. I'm basing that on what other people told me, but The Good Fight was very good. And that should have been, I think more people would have been talking about it if it was on regular CBS and more people were actually able to watch it. Yeah. I don't know that they found a way to convince people to pay for that all access subscription.
Yeah, I think a lot of these so-called over-the-top services are going to run into the problem of consumers who may already have Amazon Prime and thus have Amazon Prime Video and already have Netflix. You know, they're not even extending their dollars out to Hulu, let alone going for, you know, CISO or CBS All Access, or, you know, when ESPN goes to a paid service, and in 2 years, Disney's going to have paid services and all the rest. You know, people cut the cord because they wanted to cut their expenses, but now they got to pay all these individual prices for all of these things instead of getting a bundle of them all together like you would on cable or satellite. It just seems like they're asking too much for content that isn't necessarily that compelling, or am I missing something?
No, I agree with that. And I think it's only going to be more of a challenge for the CBS All Accesses of the world because of what you just mentioned, which is the Disney-Fox merger, assuming that that goes through as planned, and Disney rolls out a streaming service. They're going to have so much content in their stable based on what Disney owns already, plus what they acquire from Fox. And as part of that merger, Disney will now be a majority stake owner in Hulu. And so I think that means Hulu would potentially be even more competitive with Netflix than it is now. I think Hulu is very good, not only for some of their original programming, but also if you don't want to subscribe to cable, but you want to try to keep up with what's on network television to some degree and cable television to some degree. You know, a lot of shows that air, they end up on Hulu the very next day. And so I think that service has a lot to offer and may offer even more with this whole Disney situation.
All right, the last thing I want to ask you about is late night. We didn't see any changes of hosts in 2017, but we saw a change in the ratings of some of these hosts, with Stephen Colbert pulling ahead with more of his anti-Trump stuff, and Jimmy Kimmel with, you know, his health insurance stuff and his baby and all of that sort of stuff. He's pulling to a point where, has he caught Fallon yet for second place?
You know, I don't know. I don't think he has quite yet, but he has certainly, I think, surpassed Fallon this year just in terms of buzz and media interest and capturing headlines for the reasons you just said. And I think the watchword this year was politics, politics, politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jimmy Fallon really put himself at a distance from that with a couple of exceptions. And has tried to be like the fun guy in late night. And at least at this particular moment, that doesn't seem to be what people want. And it's not what people are, brings a bigger spotlight onto you either.
Do you think NBC is nervous about that? Can they even push Fallon to do more? Or is he just incapable of that because he is only going to be the fun guy no matter how much you push him?
Yeah, I don't think that is not his expertise. That's not who he is.
Yeah.
And I don't know how worried NBC is about that in the long term. You know, the other thing is, following Fallon, you have Seth Meyers, who has very much embraced the political side. He kind of retooled his show a little bit at the beginning of the year. And, you know, in late night now, I feel like it's still about the ratings, but maybe even more so it's about how many people are watching your clips online the next morning and talking about you on Twitter and things like that. And I think, again, Seth Meyers was surpassing Fallon in that regard, too. So if they really, really start to get worried, they've got Seth Meyers in the house already.
You're absolutely right. One other late night thing I have to mention, which supersedes all the other shows we've just talked about. I think the moment in late night this year had to be Melissa McCarthy as Sean Spicer on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, it was something. And Saturday Night Live got tons of Emmy nominations this year. Not just because of her, although she was nominated, but just because of, again, the way it was kind of speaking directly to this extremely unusual political moment that we were dealing with.
Yep.
I will say that in this current season, as opposed to the season that ended earlier in the year, I think the writing hasn't been quite as strong.
Yeah, I agree.
They lost their head writers from last season and have replaced them with other people. And it's still funny, but it was really, really sharp.
I think the Alec Baldwin Trump is getting old.
It is getting old. It is. And it's not really, it's almost like it's a recap of what you saw this week, but it's just Alec Baldwin doing it instead of Trump. And it's not necessarily, I think Weekend Update sometimes is, you know, a little bit funnier and incisive on that stuff than the cold opens, which with Alec Baldwin are.
I agree. All right. Well, if you want to see Jen's list of the best new shows of the year and the best overall shows of the year, you can find them at Vulture.com, where she is the TV critic. Thanks so much for joining me today. And I guess I'll talk to you in 2018. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Thanks so much, Paul.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.